All right, this hour we'll continue chatting with Stephen Schwartz, but we'll also take your calls and also your life event stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Stephen Schwartz with us. Stephen, what do you mean by matrix of life?
Well, the prevailing materialist view is that, we just speak here of consciousness, is that each consciousness is independent, that your consciousness is physiologically based, that is, it's created by the physiology of your body, that dead consciousness, dead meat, no consciousness, that the only way consciousness can interact is through the normal, regularly recognized senses, and that it is entirely contained within space-time. That's the materialist view. We're all kind of locked into our heads, and the only way we connect is, you know, we talk or we make sounds or we smell or whatever. But there is an emerging worldview that is taking over science. It's not yet the dominant view, but it's getting very close there. And that one says that we live in a matrix of life in which all life is interdependent and interconnected. That while some of our consciousness is physiologically based, that's the local consciousness, there is an aspect of consciousness that is not physiologically based. This is the part that survives. This is the part that has creative breakthroughs. This is the part that has spiritual epiphanies. This is the near-death part that experiences a near-death event. This is the part of us that survives. This is the part that reincarnates. That this aspect is in contact with this matrix of life and is both informed and informing of it. It's a two-way street. It's like the internet. And that this aspect of consciousness is not constrained within space-time, because we know that it is possible, for instance, for people to describe things before they happen. I mentioned earlier about the presentment research in which your body responds before your cognitive mind is even aware that the stimulus is occurring. This is the part that, you know, about 4.2% of the American public has reported a near-death experience. The actual number is much larger because lots of people never talk about
it. No, they don't want to.
Yeah, they don't. Family and friends, you know, it makes them look weird or whatever. But so that's 13 million people right there. That 4.2% of you, you know, we're about 317 million people. So about a little over, not quite 4.5% of us have these experiences. Of course, a number of them have become very famous and been best-selling books and have been made into movies, that sort of thing. But it's a remarkably common occurrence, and doctors become ever more familiar with it and become aware of it. And there's also there's a whole new subspecialty of medicine that has arisen just literally in the last decade, resuscitation medicine. And they're now resuscitating people. You know, it used to be thought that if you were dead, no brain activity, no heart, that for about 5 minutes that brain cells began to deteriorate and that it was very difficult to bring you back, if at all. Well, in the published literature now, they're now talking about bringing people back after 6 hours. And I have seen commentary that there, as long as they can keep you cool and keep your blood oxygenated so that there's not deterioration, they might be able to bring you back as long as 24 hours after no brain activity occurs. So the argument that, for instance, near-death experiences or dying brains or ketamine-like experience, I mean, that just becomes kind of absurd, that argument. Because what's happening in these longer and longer resuscitations, and these are people who are not speaking retrospectively of something that happened in the past, but who are literally in an emergency room, for instance, or in a surgical suite, and they're being very carefully monitored in all sorts of ways, and they experience a near-death experience, and when they come back, they report things that they simply could not know. They wouldn't even be able to know if they were in the room and were alive. An example is, this is one reported by a cardiologist in Holland called Pim van Lommel. A guy was, a typical story, you know, he woke up, he was out of his body, he could see people, he was looking down at himself and the doctors. He couldn't get anybody to pay any attention to him, and he said he suddenly realized that his teeth, he didn't have his teeth. So he went down the hospital corridor across the hospital to where his hospital room had been, because he remembered he'd put his teeth in the bedside table. And when he got there, he saw this nurse, and he described her in great detail. And he said, she took my teeth out of the drawer at the bedside table and put them in a little box and took them in and put them up on the shelf in the nurse's station. And in fact, that turns out to be exactly what happened. And because the nurse logged it into his chart, they knew exactly when it happened. And at the time that it happened, he was dead. So we look at these kinds of things. We look at, for instance, the remote viewing research. I mean, they're now literally millions of remote viewing sessions. It's the only laboratory protocol that's become a social movement. I mean, I can tell you, as one of the founders of remote viewing, that when Russ Targ and Hal Puthoff and I and Ed May and Jim Spottiswood, a few other people, Ingo Swann, were beginning remote viewing, it never occurred to us that this little laboratory protocol that we were working on, and which was essentially designed to allow people to make what's called a free response, that is to talk like a normal person and not have to just answer specific questions, that free response data could be objectively verified. That's what we wanted. And it was even better if we could do it so that at the time they were giving the data, that the target had not yet been selected, so that it was completely triple blind. Nobody knew what the target was, so there was no chance of queuing or faking or any, you know, any kind of cheating.
Or guesswork.
Or anything. Yeah, it doesn't make any difference, whatever. We discovered that people could do this, and in fact, they could do it quite robustly. Well, that little laboratory protocol that the PAIR group at Princeton and the Mobius lab, my lab, or the SRI lab that we were doing, you know, it's this little group of guys that were doing this, this has now become a huge avocational interest. That, you know, there's thousands of people on Yahoo discussion lists and Google discussion lists and Facebook discussion lists, and there's conferences and magazines, and so it's become an avocational interest. And if that is true, because people can see to their own satisfaction, they know whether they're cheating or not, that that they can do this. And in order to do it, this new version of consciousness has to be true. It's clearly people have the ability to move unrestricted by time or space. We know that it is as easy to describe something that's close up as it is something far away, or that it's easy to describe something that lies in the future or something that lies in the distant past. All my archaeology work was really about people looking at the past, stuff that had been forgotten. I mean, if people knew where it was, we wouldn't have been looking for it. So you look at that research, you look at the therapeutic intention research, this idea that the consciousness of one individual has an effect on the well-being of another organism. You look at this presentment work I was describing. There's another protocol called staring, where people, you know, everybody's had this experience. You pull up to the stoplight, and you feel like somebody's staring at you, and you look over, and somebody is staring.
Yeah, or you can feel it. You can feel their eyes behind your head.
That's right. And so, but we do this experimentally under very rigorous control. For instance, you would be in one room, and you would be hooked up to an EEG, and I would be anywhere. I could be across the hall. I could be across the country. Doesn't make any difference. And what you don't know is while you're sitting there, say, reading a magazine, there's a television camera that's on you, and most of the time it's just white noise when I look at the screen. But every once in a while, the picture of you sitting there shows up. And when that happens, we know that your brainwaves exchange.
The whole system is so strange. How does it work, Stephen? What makes it work? I mean, is this a natural part of the universe?
Yes. I would suspect although it's becoming increasingly, you see it in physics and quantum biology, you know, fields like that. I think what we're looking at is that the non-local domain is a domain of information. That is, if you remember the movie The Matrix, I think the Wachowskis got it right. I mean, they, of course, have a dramatic story all around it, but basically what we're looking at is information structures. You know, Planck, the father of quantum mechanics.
Stephen, I think I'm going to lose you on the phone any second here. You're breaking up. So keep going, but be aware that we could lose you, okay?
Is that better? Are we doing better now?
What'd you do?
I changed phones.
Oh, all right.
I live on an island, and so the phone system is a little odd, so I have another phone.
Okay, well, so far, I'll let you know if there's a problem with that one. Go ahead. Yeah, I think there's a problem with that one, too. It's probably your line or something.
Oh, it kind of is. There's nothing I can do about that. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but you're breaking up. So let's keep going, but if it continues, I'm going to have to move on.
Oh, I understand. Okay. I understand the problem. I don't know what the solution is, but I understand the problem. Anyway, if you look at all this research, what it is telling us is that, in fact, we are all interconnected in this matrix of information. I started to say Max Planck, who the father of quantum mechanics, said in an interview that he gave, and he was very conscious of what he was saying, said, I've spent my life looking at materiality, and my opinion is that consciousness is fundamental, that materiality is a manifestation of consciousness.
All right, I'm going to go to some calls here, Stephen. People have been waiting, but I'll have Tom talk to you and see if there's anything we can do on that line, because it's breaking up like crazy. Paul's in Kauai, the islands of Hawaii. Paul, welcome to the show. Steven's not with you, but I am.
Hi, George. Yeah, and I had a question for Steven, and I heard him breaking up too, and I'm surprised. Hello. Was this my phone or is it his phone? Unfortunately, it was. And I had a question to ask for him to elaborate on. It had to do with wellness, society, and some of the things that he was talking about. It's kind of a poli-sci question, but it has to do with something that's hitting front page, especially in Oahu papers and stuff like that. And talking about if he wanted to, even though we could spend a whole program dealing with it, on homelessness and social services, chosen or not by choice, of those who deal with it. And I don't know if my question is appropriate for the format.
I want you to elaborate it, because I don't understand the question.
Well, the question is, we're dealing with wellness for society or people in general, correct?
Mm-hmm. We're supposed to.
Supposed to. Okay, according to what me listening to the program so far and what I interpreted. And it's kind of like, economics and financial situations can be chosen to put somebody into. We got vets that are homeless. We got people who are homeless, not by their choice, but because of other economic factors. But then we got other people who choose to go that route because it's easier to get it than it is to work for a living. Now, I'm retired and stuff like that. And for an example, using me personally, it's kind of like, well, I used to have a fantastic medical insurance policy because of how I worked and what I did earlier, and now I have Medicare, and that's about it. And
listen, 46 million Americans are on food stamps. Some of them want to be on food stamps, so they do this. They don't work. But there are a lot of people who just can't afford it. Steven, I think we got a new connection with you.
I hope so. Can you hear me now better?
Well, I'm not going to judge it based on just a few seconds, so I got to listen a little longer.
Yes, but I understand. I was listening to the question. I mean, sir, I hear the beginning of your question, but I get the gist of the thing. I would observe two things. We send 17 million children to bed in the United States hungry every night. I live on an island where we have 26,000 people, and my wife bakes 6 dozen organic treats every week to feed all of the children that are on this little island who have such low incomes. Their parents are working 2, maybe 3 jobs. We have not made wellness a national priority. Other societies do this. It can be done. It doesn't require you sacrificing something. It requires a proactive choice that it is important that when all of us do better, when everybody does better, we have greater wellness. There is a reason. If you look at the social outcome data, you will see that, for instance, the United States is not a very happy country when you compare it to other countries. And when you talk to people about this, it is because they feel that the system isn't working, that somehow that's rigged in some way that they can't get hold of, and that they're powerless. And what I'm proposing to you is that if enough people make a choice to choose the compassionate, life-affirming choice, whatever it is, that we can change this. This is not foreordained. It is not, I understand everybody loves cabals and secret conspiracies and all that, but the truth of the matter is that we are powerful, and that when we get out and vote, when we choose the things which are compassionate and life-affirming, things get better. They got better. The world got better. We have gone backwards. If I don't know how old you are, but you're on Medicare, so you're at least as old as I am. And you can remember that in the 60s and 70s, that people were upwardly mobile. They thought of themselves as being able to improve. This is the first generation in American history that does not think that its children will do better than it did.
Well, since 2007, Stephen, have people just simply given up? Not all the people, but some of them.
I think a significant number of people have given up. They just feel that they have no power in the system, that it is rigged. And it is true. With Citizens United, we have given the permission for an oligarchy to buy the government. They don't even make any bones about it. I mean, the Koch brothers alone and their allies are going to put 10% of the money being spent for advertising. This is a handful of people that are going to put 10% of the money that's going to be spent for the election to buy the government that they want.
That's happened before. It'll happen again. Stephen, we're going to try another half hour with you because so many people are on hold. We'll be back. Got an email from someone who was talking about the Hush Puppy shoes. They talk about how this stuff seems to work. He said the company was really in trouble when it first started. And then without advertising, young people started buying these shoes, and the business exploded. How does that happen? We're going to come back. We'll take your call. Stephen Schwartz with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Stephen Schwartz with us. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Stephen, that story I was talking about with Hush Puppies, truly, they succeeded without any major advertising at the time. And, again, it's as if people are just linked together via, like, ESP.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to say to you, was that I was listening to, you know, I hear the ads when we're on breaks, and I thought, my God, the Hush Puppy story is an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about. How did that company take off? Because a whole bunch of kids decided that they would do it, and they passed it on to their friends, and it suddenly caught on, and boom, the rest is history. That is the process. And we see this process in a lot of different ways, but we don't recognize it. And we particularly don't recognize this non-local aspect, that there is this shift in gestalt which occurs. This is how archetypes get created, for instance. You know, the Joseph Campbell's Hero of 1,000 Faces, the idea that throughout all cultures, there are these same sort of recurring dramatic themes that come up. And where are they? Where do those things get stored? And the answer is they are in the non-local, what Rudolf Bastian called the elemental human thoughts.
Stephen, let's take some calls. Folks have been waiting for you. Let's go to Gary in Santa Maria, California. Gary, go ahead. You're on with Stephen Schwartz.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Stephen, I talked to you the last time that you were on with George, and we ran out of time at the end of the hour, and you weren't quite able to get back to the question. But I got involved with you by proxy in 2003, March 2nd, when I was one of 137 people that participated in James Spottiswood's galvanic skin response experiment out at by Griffith Park, and I scored, I think they told me, in the top 2%, and that put me on every white paper that you, May, Spottiswood, your colleagues have ever done. I've been actively practicing that stuff ever since. My hat's off to you, and I thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
What George is doing with his campaign on the electromagnetic pulse, with the potential of a third party not getting traction because of the establishment Democrats and the establishment Republicans, I think it may be time for a non-third party. Just clean up our own parties, get rid of the establishment Republicans, get rid of the establishment Democrats from within. No candidate, just get rid of the scum that's in those two parties. The best way to accomplish that, I believe, and I would love your comment on this, is to get more celebrity involvement. And that would be the hook to explain to celebrities at what great risk they're putting themselves at by having their public persona out of sync with their private persona. And you know very well what I'm talking about. I don't think they understand how Farrah Fawcett, Michael J. Fox, Morton Downey Jr., the list goes on and on of celebrities that have either had huge cancers that were sex objects, sex symbols, or have spun out of control emotionally with drugs because of this one thing. You hook the celebrities by offering them protection and fixes by positive intention from their followings, which are in the millions and millions. You tie it into the three most emotional issues out there: George's electromagnetic pulse, which some people's eyes glaze over, GMO labeling, and NSA spying. Those three issues, most thinking people would agree, coincide. You wrap those up in a non-third party, focus on getting rid of the establishment Republicans and Democrats. Who are they? They're the ones that voted to continue to fund NSA spying. Half of the Republicans, half of the Democrats voted to defund NSA. The establishment Republicans on the Amash Amendment voted to increase it. We only lost by 6 votes, but the ugly snake stuck its head out from both parties, and we need to chop the heads off of both those snakes by a non-third party working from within to get rid of the darn establishment.
All right, take a breath here for a second, Gary. Well, a little reaction there, Stephen.
Well, there's several things. I mean, I've covered a lot of stuff, but I would say two things to you initially, Gary. One is that you have touched on something very important, and that is when you are a public personality, it is very important that the private personality and the public personality be resonant with one another. The reason that you see celebrities crash and burn, particularly religious people, is that they set up a public personality which has a certain set of values, which they talk about, but in their private lives, that is not who they are. And their followers have focused an enormous amount of intentioned, focused awareness on the public personality. As I said, remember, the consciousness of an individual can have an effect on the well-being of another organism if the conscious intention is focused enough so that the non-local linkage can occur. And so what you have over and over again is public personalities whose private selves are at variance, and over time, it creates an impossible dissonance because all of their followers, their fans, whatever, are focused on this public personality, but it is not the private self, and so it creates this dissonance which causes the breakdown. And you see this over and over again, particularly where values are involved, where people who set themselves up with values and everybody signs up for that, who are their followers or their fans or whatever, and they focus on that when in fact the person's consciousness is not consistent with their public personality. That's the first thing. The second thing is George's EM, the EM pulse. I've been following that since I was in the government back in the 70s and was special assistant to CNO, and we worried about that. It's still a worry. It's interesting that we seem to do so little about it. I think it's because the calculation is that it's not possible yet for people who mean us harm to be able to produce a big enough pulse, but I think that that is certainly one of the things that is coming. There is no question that we live in what by any other time in history would be considered a police state. I mean, if you realize that everything you say or everything that's digitized, if it comes over your cell phone or your computer or your tablet or your whatever, all of that is being recorded. Now, I heard somebody earlier on one of George's comments, it isn't just that they do anything with it, it's the fact that it's being collected. That alters people. When people know that they're being watched, it alters their behavior. So we have a big problem culturally in this country, and that is we have created, out of excessive fear, we have created a police state. And you really don't get this until you go outside of the United States and spend time in another country, and you realize that the fear level in the rest of the world is much, much lower, even though the actuality of something that might cause fear would be higher, but that the day-to-day living of people is much less fearful than it is now. So that's one thing. There are a whole series of these trends. I'll give you another one. By 2035, for the first time in 500 years, and certainly for the totality of American history going back to the colonial period, being born white will not confer privilege. And you think, well, I don't get a lot of privileges. But the fact is that we have it's invisible because it's so widespread. And it's causing enormous anxiety in certain areas and amongst certain segments of the population that we will be a majority-minority country. And as a result of that, being born white isn't going to give you an extra edge. And that's very fear-inducing in a lot of people. So that's a whole other trend that's going on that we need to be aware of. We need to our public conversation, and you can see this, you turn on the television, cable news any day, our public conversation is about things that don't matter, that don't actually threaten any of the substantive structure of the culture. We spend hours and hours and days talking about things which are, you know, maybe individually, episodically important, or certainly to the people that are involved, but that don't really have massive social implications. And the things that do have massive social implications, we don't talk about them. We just don't have public discourse on this. One of the nice things that I like about Coast to Coast is that they're willing to give a venue, a place to speak for people who have all kinds of different points of view without assigning value judgments
sure.
on it.
Without ridicule.
Yeah, without ridicule. And that is very important. We need to be able to stand up and speak without feeling that we're going to be ridiculed for whatever it is we're saying, and that people will listen, and that important issues like climate change, the collapse of antibiotic medicine. How much have you read about that? Well, this is a huge problem. as a result of industrial agriculture and the overuse of antibiotics in industrial animal husbandry, which floods our waterways and pollutes our soil, we have developed these superbugs that are resistant to all antibiotics. And if you have had a recent experience in an American hospital and other hospitals, not just in America, you realize the rise of these superbugs has got doctors terrified.
There's nothing they can do about it, Stephen.
That's right. And so that's a whole trend. When was the last time you turned on any television cable show and you heard somebody talking about that? We don't talk about it. We don't talk about the transition out of carbon energy into non-polluting energy. And yet it's this huge thing that's going on. Burlington, Vermont, the whole town. And think about it. A large city in Vermont has gone entirely non-carbon. You'd think that everybody would be talking about that. No, you don't hear anybody talking about it. We're not talking about the substantive issues. Therefore, we are not reaching the kinds of critical consensus which allow us to make choices which will produce a wellness-oriented society.
All right, let's take one or two more calls. Jane in Kansas City, Missouri is up with us now. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine.
Hey, my life-changing story, you know, where one person can make a difference. I read a thing about Organite and Cloudbusters and combating the chemtrails, and I thought, why not? I'm going to give it a try.
Give it a try.
Okay, give it a try. So I started making Organite and gave it to friends, and I kept hearing good things about it. And the first time I made a batch, I had the meter man or a man from the water company come out and put in a new smart meter for our water meter. The smart meter quit working after I made this batch of Organite. I've got a friend in Chicago that she swears by it saves her. She is very sensitive to the smart meters and all the electro.
A lot of people,
you know,
are.
She says, and this helps her. And my Cloudbuster, it's amazing.
You're a little inventor. Jeez.
Hello?
You're an inventor.
I'm not an inventor. I am a reader. Learned to research, and I went on what somebody else, this is off of Wilhelm Reich's invention,
sure.
And when I read that they burned 6 tons of his paperwork, I'm thinking,
they almost burned him to the stake as well. Stephen, how did you get involved with dealing with the mind?
I had experiences when I was 24. I was working in New York as a screenwriter. I had been working for National Geographic, and I got drafted, you know, like everybody else my age. And when I got out of the service, I wrote a movie that got made. I mean, I'd never done it before. I did it, and it worked out anyway. And I had a series of experiences that I simply couldn't explain. And so I went down through a very odd set of circumstances. I was introduced to the Edgar Cayce material, and I spent 4 years reading all of the Edgar Cayce readings, and I read everything that had been published to that date in parapsychological literature, and I started doing comparative comparative religion studies, and I'm still doing it, but I mean very intensely for about 5-6 years. And out of that, I got interested in doing experiments because I like data. And so I started doing what I call distant viewing experiments. The term remote viewing was coined by Ingo Swann some years later. But I started out doing what I call these distant viewing experiments, which was getting people to describe. I'd bury things and get them to describe them. And one thing led to another, and I began to ask the question, is this electromagnetic? That is, are we looking at some kind of radio phenomena? And a man named Leonid Vasilyev, who was in the then Soviet Union in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, had also asked this question about, is it electromagnetic? And he had done a whole series of experiments putting people into mines and down into caves and in Faraday cages. and he discovered it didn't make any difference. And he said the only part of the electromagnetic spectrum that's left is ELF, extreme low frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you could test for that would be to put somebody in a submarine. And he had gone to Admiral Gorshkov, the father of the nuclear Soviet nuclear navy, you know, blue water navy. And so I had a friend who was at the CIA, and he was sending me all these translations of this man's papers. And I went and asked Hyman Rickover, who was then the father of the American nuclear navy, if I could go aboard a submarine and get a couple of sailors to do this distant viewing experiment. And he said no. And then several years later, two friends of mine, Don Walsh and Don Keach, who were both the Navy's leading deep ocean submarine experts, offered me the use of a submarine. And I did an experiment called Deep Quest. You can go to YouTube and see it. I made a film out of it. And that convinced me, based on the evidence, that it was not electromagnetic and that it was an aspect of consciousness that I began to think of as non-local consciousness. And so, you know, one thing led to another, and 50 years later, I'm still doing research.
Well, and it's great research indeed. Stephen's websites, again, are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and his book, Opening to the Infinite. Well done, by the way, Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, thanks for being on Coast to Coast AM. Appreciate it. In a moment, of course you dream, don't you? Do you remember your dreams, and what do they mean? In a moment, Kelly Sullivan Walden joins me. We're going to talk about dreams here on Coast to Coast AM and some of the things that she's going to tell you about the dream state just might shock you. Kelly's next with us on Coast to Coast AM.